Good morning, dear friends. This is the fourth in the series of four sessions dealing with aspects of the Baha'i teachings which concern matter and spirit and their interrelations. In the first session, we looked at passages from the writings which speak of the existence of the two worlds, the material and spiritual worlds, the fact that we dwell simultaneously in both worlds, and any actions we take have consequences in both dimensions. This led us into enumerating the foundations of the Baha'i teachings on this subject, and that in the second session gave rise to examination of what Abdu'l-Bahá refers to as the magnetic principle, using magnetism as the analogy for the fact that actions or attitudes which are in conformity with a divinely prescribed law, be that a law of nature or a law of the revelation, that such actions attract spiritual powers in a similarity to those of magnetism. Then we went on to look at the categories of spirit which are attracted and the various categories set out in the teachings, including, of course, the human spirit, which is of crucial significance to creation. In yesterday's session, we took it a step further to application over a period of time. Until that time, we just looked at it as a one shot in terms of the fact of the attraction of spirit in response to appropriate attitudes or actions. And we saw there that in the teachings, the application over a period of time involves invoking some additional principles of the faith. The first being the fact that Abdu'l-Bahá states that change is a necessary part of existence, that things will and always will change, and therefore we should adjust to that and ensure that the change is positive and constructive. Any attempt to not change means by clear implication that we're going backwards. We then looked at the fact that in applying the magnetic principle, it is important that we recognize what I called a feedback effect. You make an effort and it gives rise to a certain result. That certain result then strengthens you and you can make an even greater effort and give rise to an even greater result. All this predicated on the fact that the guardians tell us that the principal value in our religion is effort rather than achievement. And the fact that effort is of greatest significance to us leads us to the statement that Abdu'l-Bahá made in setting the foundation stone of the temple at Wilmette, which is a statement of general significance, that the important thing is to make a start, that having made a start, you plug yourself in to this cycle of effort, achievement, leading to greater effort, leading to greater achievement. This feedback cycle in advertising, if you're selling skin cream, is called the itch cycle. That you have an irritation on your hand, you scratch it, and that leads to a result which makes you scratch even more, and then that in turn leads to you wanting to scratch even further, so it goes on. And then we saw that this very simple minded model of effort leading to achievement, leading to greater effort and so on, is perturbed by the fact that creation involves a challenge and test. That when we make the effort, we are generally tested and we have to summon up our resources to overcome the test, and that leads us to the desired result, which attracts the spirit and empowers us to go further, and that in turn leads to the raising up of further obstacles which are overcome in order to achieve an even greater measure of spiritual reward. And we looked at where the guardian had set that out in relation to the development of the Baha'i community and how he described the growth of the Baha'i community as being a series of rhythmic pulsations by virtue of the operation of this cyclic thing of effort and achievement and leading to greater effort, leading to greater achievement. And I made the personal inference that that applies to us as individuals. Things are never even or linear, some more than others. I might mention that for many years when I served in the Holy Land, one of the things I would do, among other things, of course, was to meet with pilgrims who came from a 9-day pilgrimage. And an essential element of that 9-day pilgrimage was to go to the holy shrines. And so we'd have 200 or more pilgrims come, and they were greeted by our pilgrimage department and taken to the shrines. In some cases, it was a very wonderful experience. In other cases, it wasn't. Some people would go to the shrines for the first time, say the Shrine of the Bab, for example, and they were totally overcome, absolutely floored by the power of the shrines. They would weep, they would sink to their knees, they'd be almost unable to move. There was a tremendous, deep spiritual experience. Others went to the shrines, and it was as if they felt like a tourist. They went in and find everyone else is down on their knees, so they do likewise. They put their forehead to the threshold, and they look around, and that area needs painting, and this curtain has a little tear in it, and so on and so forth. And they realize that they appear to be getting nothing from the shrines, whereas others around them are weeping and the like. This then makes them feel very discouraged, as if they must be some terribly unspiritual being, that they've come to the holy shrines as an essential element of pilgrimage and they're not getting anything from it. And what I do is talk to pilgrims about this sort of thing and raise it with them and tell them that if you're part of the second category, never mind. Don't worry about it. Don't get yourself in a lather over it. That the whole process of spiritual development has ebb and flow. Times when you're really plugged in, times when you're not. And that applies to all elements of human existence. If you look physiologically, there are cyclic phenomena in the physiology of the human being and endocrine and all that kind of stuff. And so we have medical doctors prescribing medicines to be given at a certain time in the day because that's most appropriate to the physiology of this cyclic variations over a day or over a month or the like. So I say to them, don't worry about it. It is simply a cyclic thing that today you went and you didn't feel like it, tomorrow you go and you feel like it tremendously, or it's something that builds up over a period of time during the pilgrimage, or it may not build up till after the pilgrimage is over. You may go through the whole 9 days of pilgrimage and it's as if you're a tourist for those 9 days, but it's all been recorded in your memory, and as you think about it and meditate on it in weeks and months to come, so the spiritual impact will come to you. So it's all part of the fact that what we're talking about are fairly simplified descriptions of things that are very complex because they involve human beings. So far, and until this morning, what we've done is talk about the individual and the individual's functioning as a means of attracting spiritual powers and developing himself or herself on an individual basis. What I want to do today is to draw on passages of the writings which indicate that we function best in the process of spiritual development, that we function best with interaction with other human beings. This is a fairly radical idea in religion, because traditionally religion has called upon individuals to perfect their spiritual character in isolation. That's why we have monasteries. That's why we have spiritual retreats. That's why over the history of religion, individuals have gone off to live in the desert or to live in a cave, to separate themselves from the rest of society in order to clean up their act, to develop themselves spiritually and to refine their character. This is not a concept that is endorsed in the Baha'i teachings. Going off by yourself for a period of time is okay, it's legitimate. If obviously we have the record of Baha'u'llah going to Sulaymaniyah at a certain stage from the Baghdad period. We have the record of Abdul Baha after the passing of Baha'u'llah going and dwelling in the cave of Elijah at the head of Mount Carmel as he dealt with the adjustment to the absence of Baha'u'llah, as Janet has been mentioning in the sessions on Bahia Kanum. We do have Shoghi Effendi going to Switzerland for a period of time as he prepared for assuming the full weight of the guardianship of the cause. These are temporary, they are of a limited duration, quite different from what we're talking about this morning. In the Kitab-i Aqdas, Baha'u'llah reveals how many a man has secluded himself in the climes of India, denied himself the things God had decreed as lawful, imposed upon himself austerities and mortifications, and goes on to point out that this is not appropriate at this time. In another place in the tablets of Baha'u'llah, he says, "O people of the earth, living in seclusion or practicing asceticism is not acceptable in the presence of God. It behoveth them that are endued with insight and understanding to observe that which will cause joy and radiance." Again, we have to be careful where we take that. It doesn't mean that anyone who lives in seclusion is violating the teachings. If you're, say, a nomad taking care of cattle or horses in Mongolia or the like, or you're a lighthouse keeper, or you're on an Antarctic expedition, something like that, you're living in seclusion for a period, but it's not for the purpose of religious development, it's the purpose of carrying out your job. It's quite different. Why is it that we have in our religion the view that the individual best develop himself or herself spiritually by interacting with the larger society? It seems to me that that derives from a very interesting principle set out in the Baha'i teachings. And I want to read that to you. Shoghi Effendi states in one place, "We cannot segregate the human heart from the environment outside us and say that once one of these is reformed, everything will be improved. Man is organic with the world. His inner life molds the environment and is itself also deeply affected by it. The one acts upon the other, and every abiding change in the life of man is the result of these mutual reactions. And that seems to be to encapsulate the basic theory on which our interaction with society rests, that it is an interactive relationship. The individual is affected by the society around him and is in turn, he has an effect upon it. And that interactive relationship is constructive to the development of his spiritual being and also to the development of society. And that then gives rise to a whole variety of Baha'i teachings. This cleanliness thing we've been wrestling with for several days derives from this principle of the interaction between the individual and the environment. The injunction in the Baha'i teachings to develop cities and towns and the whole basic environment of the earth, which will, of course, will be accomplished to a greater extent in the golden age of the cause, derives from that and the like. A whole lot of things in the teachings can be collected together under that principle, leaving aside the teachings which relate to the improvement of the environment and climate change and the solving problems of the pollution of the earth and the like. What I want to do this morning is to look at some examples of aspects of the teachings which refer to the individual developing spiritually or drawing on spiritual powers through interaction with the larger society. And I'll take a few examples, there are obviously a whole lot more, but they are taken in order to illustrate the point that I've made already, that the individual in our religion develops best through interaction with others and with the larger society. One example, and probably the most fundamental example, is that of the covenant. We're told in our religion that the individual develops through adherence to the covenant, that it is, this is an absolutely indispensable element of spiritual growth, and that that interaction with the covenant involves a relationship with others. For example, Shoghi Effendi in God Passes By refers to statements of Abdu'l-Bahá about the covenant. And lo and behold, to our immense satisfaction, he quotes Abdu'l-Bahá as saying that the covenant is the magnet of God's grace. That by our adherence to the covenant, we attract miraculous spiritual powers. The grace of God is channeled through our adherence to the covenant, just as a magnet has spirit, has a magnetic powers associated with it. Abdu'l-Bahá clarifies this in innumerable places. Let me read only one of them. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "Be ye assured with the greatest assurance that verily God will help those who are firm in his covenant in every matter, through his confirmation and favor. He will make them the signs of guidance among the creation and shining and glittering stars from all horizons." So any discussion of spiritual development of the individual, any reference to the individual in relation to those around him or her, must necessarily begin with the condition of the covenant as a crucial element. This is obviously not the time or the place to try and attempt an exposition of the covenant. It is a very big subject. It relates to the fact that ordained in our religion are institutions which derive their authority from Baha'u'llah, which have a defined function in relation to the believers, which are a source of preserving the purity of the faith, of maintaining unity, maintaining the flexibility and the integrity of the teachings and of the Baha'i community. And I'm sure that all of you are very familiar with the details of the covenant and the local assemblies and national assemblies and House of Justice, Hands of the Cause, councillors, auxiliary board members, their assistants and so on. And it's a vast subject which we don't want to even get into. What I rather want to do for a few minutes is to step back from it and say, okay, I accept what Abdu'l-Bahá says, that the covenant is the magnet of God's grace. I accept the fact that through our adherence to the covenant, we attract spiritual powers. I'm not arguing with that or questioning it. All I'm saying is, why does it work that way? How does it happen to be? What is it about my adherence to the covenant that gives rise to attitudes which conduce to spiritual growth? And I want to set out a few of the answers I've given myself. Firstly, the most fundamental answer is the fact that through adherence to the covenant, I become part of a Baha'i community that doesn't tear itself apart. In other words, through adherence to the covenant, I create the foundation of a community which is not self-destructive. About a week ago, the Taliban put bombs in a mosque somewhere in northwest Pakistan, or maybe Peshawar or someplace, and blew up a whole lot of the faithful. Very horrible thing, made all the various newspapers of the world. These were a bunch of Shias who were praying together, and the Taliban, who have a Sunni connection, put a bomb there and killed them while they were at prayer. That relates to the covenant. And of course, the other way around, in Kerman, in Iran, again around the same time, the reverse happened. Shias killed the Sunnis who were engaged in worship in a Sunni mosque. All of that gives point to our adherence to the covenant, that from the very beginning of Islam, with the passing of Muhammad and the appointment of Ali as Imam and the decision of the majority of the fledgling Muslim community in Medina to nominate or elect Abu Bakr as Caliph, followed by Umar and Uthman and so on, the covenant was shattered in Islam. That was in the year 632, and now 1400 years later, we have Shia and Sunni tearing each other apart, destroying the foundations of their religion, creating a horrible situation for devout, sincere, devoted Muslims who are caught in the maelstrom of the Shia-Sunni calamity which is affecting their religion. So when we read passages in the writings of the faith which refer to the importance of adherence to the covenant, we might well look at that in the context of historical circumstance, not simply of Shia-Sunni tensions, but also the tensions within other religions of the prophetic cycle between the... by golly, that lady needs a some water again. Oh, you're right, okay. The tensions between Catholics and Protestants, between Orthodox and Catholics, if you look at the whole mess of the Balkans and Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia and the like, all looking at those things historically and in their contemporary form may well be the most fundamental reason why we say that adherence to the covenant is a necessary condition for our spiritual development, because otherwise one is led into circumstances where the foundations of the religion are violated, as is occurring with the suicide bombers and the violence afflicting the relationship between Shia and Sunni in the Muslim world. But there are other reasons. Our adherence to the covenant involves recognizing human vulnerability to ego-driven views. When we are adhering to the covenant, we are accepting the fact that we are not always 100% right and everyone else is a stupid idiot. We're recognizing the fact that in some cases where we think we are very right and we have this wonderful idea that's the best thing since Einstein, that in fact it's our ego. And that we are vulnerable to being affected by these ego-driven views. We can become obsessive about them. And our adherence to the covenant means that we are prepared to accept that we may not be right if the institutions of the faith, if the elected institutions say, nope, we're not going to do that, we don't accept it, we've decided to go another way. Another element of our adherence to the covenant, which has a spiritual effect, is our obedience to authority, even if the reason is unclear. The covenant requires us to accept and obey the decision of the elected body, even if we can't see the reason for it. We may not see the reason for it. One, it could be because we're just not very, not very bright, if you will. Or it may be that there's secret elements that the elected body doesn't want to tell us because of their confidential nature. Or it may be that it's just too complicated a matter to set out. Whatever the reason, the covenant requires us to obey even if the reason is unclear. And this is a lot to ask, because people are brought up to say, show me, tell me. If you'll explain to me, I'll go along with it. If you don't, I'm sorry, I'm not going to obey. And that, of course, is contrary to the covenant. We obey even if the reason is unclear. What makes it even worse is the writings tell us is that you obey first, then the reason will gradually become clear, rather than you say, well, I withhold obedience until the reason becomes clear. You might say, hey, what about independent investigation of truth? That's getting it all around the wrong way. We investigate the truth of Baha'u'llah's claim to be the manifestation of God. We do this independently. We decide, yes, it is right. He is a manifestation of God. I accept his claim. His claim is to be a bringer of truth. What he says is true. I've independently investigated it. And one of the things he says, which is true, is the authority of the institutions of the covenant. So it doesn't violate independent investigation of truth. Rather, it is a direct consequence of having carried that investigation and coming to its conclusions. An element of the covenant is our willingness to give authority to holy text and authoritative institutions. We conform to the law of parental consent to marriage, not because we may particularly like it or feel good about having to go to our parents on this subject, but rather because it is authoritative text and we follow it. We follow the fact of what the writings say about the impermissibility of homosexual relations between members of the Baha'i faith, whether we see the reason for it or not, whether it makes sense to it or not, whether we're going to get people criticizing us for being homophobic or whatever, we do it because it is part of the authoritative text our teachings tell us very clearly that homosexual relations, the practice of homosexual relations, is not permissible for Baha'is. And it is authoritatively interpreted by the central figures of our faith. It's not subject to change throughout this dispensation. So we give authority to it, even if the reason is not clear, even if it makes us unpopular in the society around us, and so on. You find in the Kitabi Actus reference to penal laws, to laws for punishment of various crimes. And you find that the Kitabi Actus prescribes a range of penalties for a variety of crimes, such as murder and arson and the like. And that range includes the death penalty under certain circumstances. This is tremendously unpopular in our society. Country after country is abolishing the death penalty as one of the ranges of punishment for certain crimes, such as murder or arson. We don't go around saying put everybody to death around the place, but we do say that it is a legitimate part of the range in the future when the Baha'i society is established. And we say that because it's in our teachings, whether we like it or not, whether it makes us unpopular or not, and generally these are the kinds of things that do make us unpopular in the larger society. Nevertheless, we do not yield on these things. They're part of our faith, and this is part of our covenant. One of the intriguing elements of the faith is the fact that we are told that the administrative order which derives from the covenant has a spirit associated with it, and that we draw on that spirit through our involvement in the administrative order. Shoghi Effendi refers to what he calls the spirit that has incarnated itself in the institutions of arising faith. And he goes on to say what it's done and the obstacles to it and the like. And that is quite mysterious, that by our involvement in the administration of the faith, not simply as serving as members of a body, but rather that our cooperating with it, participating in the work of the institutions of the faith, we draw on a spiritual power. The institutions of the faith give rise to a spirit which is accessible and in fact indispensable to us in our development as individuals. This leads me into a related point. I want to go back to the second session where we talked about the magnetic principle. And you remember we talked about the magnetic principle, that Abdu'l-Bahá had said that when you take the various elements and they conform to divine order, there is a spirit attracted to them. And one of the examples that is mentioned in the writings is that of the human being. Human beings represent an example of the magnetic principle, that the act of giving of pregnancy, the act of fertilization of the ovum by the spermatozoa, creates a pattern of arrangement of elements, of atoms, if you will, that attracts the spiritual power of the human spirit. And then somewhere down the road, many years later, the person dies, that pattern is disrupted, and the human spirit is no longer attracted to that body, but proceeds to the realms beyond. So an application of the magnetic principle is the pregnancy and death of human beings. The point about all that is that the magnetic principle draws our attention to the spirit being associated with that form. And we know, of course, our writings tell us that the spirit is associated with the human spirit is associated with the embryo from the time of conception. The point I want to refer to now is the fact that we, in this process, create an organic unit called an embryo. Later, that organic unit is called a baby because the thing has emerged. And later, that organic unit is called a child or a youth and an adult, and so on. It is an organic unit. It grows organically, by which I say it develops gradually, and it manifests the human spirit with which it has been endowed. It manifests it gradually. There's a point to what I'm saying. The point will become apparent in a moment. What I'm saying is that the magnetic principle gives rise to organic units which manifest their powers gradually and which are therefore readily underestimated in their early stages. Take a small child. He or she has the human spirit associated with the small child. You see that the small child, and small child has trouble doing up the buttons on the shirt because they don't have the dexterity for it. And you look at small child struggling to do up the buttons on the shirt or struggling to find its mouth with a spoonful of food or something like that. And if you didn't know better, you'd say, don't tell me this is the small child that later is going to be operating an iPad or flying a plane or doing something very complicated. Don't tell me that. The kid can't even find his mouth with a spoon. And we say, calm down. The kid's growing. Give him time. As years go by, powers unfold. And this child that can't find the buttons on his shirt will in time do highly complex things, operating nanotech machines and all sorts of stuff. It is the unfoldment of the organic unit which will unfold its powers gradually and they will become apparent. Well, why am I dwelling on this? I'm dwelling on it because there is a radical, amazing statement in the writings. It's so amazing that we tend to skate over it and not dwell on it. And that amazing statement is set out in the writings of authoritative writings of our faith, and it tells us that the institutions of the administrative order are organic units. They have the characteristics of an organic unit. When we bring into being a spiritual assembly, we are giving rise to the creation of an organic unit. We bring together the elements to make up the spiritual assembly. The thing is formed, it elects, it starts to function, and lo and behold, a new organic unit has come into the world. Just as the conception of the embryo is the creation of a new organic unit, so the institutions of the cause are organic units. What that means is that they have a life associated with them independent of the individual components. And you'll find that on occasions when you've had to deal with a local or a national assembly, sometimes when that occurs you don't notice any different, but other times it seems very, very different. Usually if you're in some kind of distress and you turn to a local assembly, you find that that's the time at which you recognize the difference of power of that institution. I dwell on this for one very definite reason, and that is I refer you to the passages in God Passes By where the writings speak of spiritual assemblies. And Abdu'l-Bahá there says, these spiritual assemblies are shining lamps and heavenly gardens from which fragrances of holiness are diffused over all regions and lights of knowledge are shed abroad over all created things. From them the spirit of life streameth in all directions, potent sources of the progress of man at all times and under all conditions. Wonderful things about the spiritual assembly, a source of the progress of humanity, all times and all conditions, spirit of life streameth in every direction. The point I'm making is that it is far from obvious initially. I've participated over 50 years in the formation of a great many spiritual assemblies in various continents of the world. And in most cases, when you form the spiritual assembly, it is initially a fragile thing that's liable to collapse if you breathe on it too hard. It shows no sign whatsoever of the spirit of life or a potent source of the progress of man at all times and all conditions. Our poor old spiritual assembly consists at most of 9 people. 3 or 4 of them have no idea what they're doing anyhow, but they've been drug along to make up the 9, and the thing survives, and eventually it elects a secretary and a chairman, and with a bit of luck it remembers to hold the feast, and it staggers along for a while till it gets it to act together. And this fragile creation continues to limp along for several years before it develops itself even further. I look at this spiritual assembly, which is hanging on by its fingertips in terms of survival, and sometimes it doesn't, it lapses and drifts. But even if it's hanging on by its fingertips, I look at it and I'd say, wait a minute, is this the thing that Abdu'l-Bahá has said is a potent source of the progress of man? From them the spirit of life streameth in every direction. I'm not even sure the thing's alive itself, let alone the... So I say to myself, how does all this fit together? Why is it that I see with my own eyes how fragile the spiritual assembly is, how much difficult it has making even the most obvious, simple decisions? Why is it that Abdu'l-Bahá refers to it as a potent source of the progress of man at all times and under all conditions? The answer lies in the concept of the organic unit. It's exactly the same as looking at this poor little kid trying to find their mouth with the teaspoon and saying, is this the kid that's going to be flying a jet plane some point in the future or operating a very complex instrument or machine? Answer, yes, because it will develop in an organic way. And so it is when you have the organic units of the administrative order, they give rise to growth and development over a period of time. It's easier in the case of children. One does become frustrated at times. The kid makes such a mess over the kitchen table by inability to find their mouth with the spoon. One does become frustrated. But nevertheless, by and large, we are patient, because we know that little kids grow up into big kids and that little kids learn all kinds of skills. So we hang in there, we're patient with the child, knowing that he or she will grow and manifest wonderful qualities. What we need to do is show the same degree of patience with our spiritual assemblies. It's easy to become frustrated with them, it's easy to dismiss them or look down one's nose at them because they have trouble deciding where to hold World Religion Day, when anybody could choose anything and be done with it and not waste a lot of time. We have to be patient with them, recognizing that they are organic units and they will grow as children grow. There are many other elements to the development of, or the access to spirit through participating in the administrative order. One of the ones I wanted to mention, which I'm not going to because of the limitations of time, I wanted to make some mention of Hakukula as another mysterious example of how spirit is channeled through the administrative order, through the individual adhering to the law of Hakukula, which is giving a certain portion of one's surplus of income minus expenditures to the head of the faith, that attracts remarkable spiritual powers, which are described in the writings. I'm not going into that this morning because a funny thing happened on the way, and that was that I was asked to speak on this subject in Melbourne at a Hakukula conference, and so at that point I set out everything I knew on the subject and a whole lot more besides. And that was then videoed, and it's going to be distributed by the Board of Trustees of Hakukula, so it'll be accessible to those who wish to study it at some point in the future. So I've chosen not to be repetitive about it today. What I want to do in the remainder of the time is to move on to a somewhat related but somewhat different subject. And what I'm going to talk about now is very strange. So far, what we've done is reasonably strange. And we've proceeded from that to somewhat little more strange by getting into organic units, the fact that the spiritual assembly is the creation of an organic unit analogous to the creation of a fertilized embryo. Now we want to finish up by going right out on a limb into very strange. And the very strange we want to do is simply this, that the writings indicate to us that these great spiritual powers are associated not only with appropriate attitudes and actions on the part of the believer, but they are associated also with things, that certain locations, certain places have a spirit associated with them. And that may seem very, very strange, as we'll see as we go along. To some of us, it isn't strange. I remember some years ago, Janet and I went to Lima, Peru. And one of the things that's in Lima, Peru is the Museum of the Inquisition. And if you go there, you can go to this Museum of the Inquisition. It is the building where the Inquisition occurred in South America. And they have these fiendish instruments of torture that were used on the poor souls who suffered the Inquisition. And you see what they did to them and the like. And the point is that when you go there, you sense a certain feeling in that building. You sense that people have suffered unspeakable agonies in that building in centuries gone by, and that has left some kind of feeling in the building. And so one is usually spontaneously moved to prayer when you visit the Museum of the Inquisition because of one's recognition that we are in a place which has been affected by intense degree of human suffering in centuries gone by. There are other locations where you go into a place and you realize that there's something about it which indicates to you that its atmosphere has been changed. When we first moved to Brisbane in the 1970s, we wanted to buy a house, and we looked at a whole bunch of houses, and I remember we went to one particular house that seemed very nicely set out and a nice location and everything about it met our needs, but it had a funny feel to it. And Jant and I independently walked around the thing and made our notes, and later when we compared notes, neither one of us could see anything wrong with the house, but we didn't want it. It didn't feel good. Later we found that the thing was being sold because of a fairly violent disruption of the marriage. And so they decided to sell the house as the marriage broke up. And it seemed to us that in that house had occurred terrible things in terms of the conflict between husband and wife, and that that had affected its atmosphere. This could be all hooey, it could be all imagination on our part, or it could have some validity. Nevertheless, at the time, we felt that the atmosphere of the place was changed by what had occurred there. So we are not unfamiliar with the view that certain locations have a certain feeling associated with them. Now we find in our religion that concept recurs. For example, let us begin with Mount Carmel itself, where, as we saw this morning on the video, where the Baha'i World Center is. The writings describe Mount Carmel as the mountain of God of immemorial sanctity. In other words, from time of antiquity, Mount Carmel has had a sanctity, a holiness associated with it. What do we mean by that? It seems to me we mean by that that there's a spiritual atmosphere associated with that mountain, which is why it's called the Mountain of God. Here we have an example of a location in the world to which spiritual association is connected. This applies in other aspects of the Baha'i teachings. One issue that came up in a meeting with the youth yesterday afternoon was the question of the DNA or the atoms of the manifestation of God. And the issue, as I understand it, can best be focused by raising a question that a believer raised with Shoghi Effendi in decades gone by. And as I understand it, the believer wrote to the Guardian and said, why is it that we should visit the holy shrines? After all, the holy shrines are where the bodily remains of a manifestation of God are buried. Nobody's questioning that. But the question is, what's different about the body of a manifestation of God that I should spend several thousands of dollars, save up for a long period of time, journey from one end of the earth to the other to say my prayers at that holy shrine? Aren't they just atoms like anybody else's atoms? Is it just carbon and nitrogen and phosphorus and calcium and all the rest of it? What's different about the remains of the manifestation of God that we say it's a holy shrine and it's a good thing to do to make a pilgrimage to it? The Guardian's reply is very interesting. On behalf of the Guardian, the response is this: the atoms of the prophets are just atoms like all others, but the association of this great spiritual power with them leaves in the place they are laid to rest a spiritual atmosphere. They are no doubt endowed with a tremendous spiritual influence and far-reaching power. But the physical characteristics of their atoms are not different from other people's any more than their bodies and physical functions are different. So in response to the to this issue that was raised yesterday afternoon. One can say the atoms and the various physiological characteristics are no different from anyone else. But the association of the spirit of the manifestation with that body has left a spiritual atmosphere associated with it, even though the manifestation spirit is not tied to that body now that it's passed to the next realm. So there is still a spiritual association, but not any change in the atomic structure or the physiological characteristics of the body. And that then gives rise, of course, to the fact that we wish to make pilgrimage to the shrines, we wish to partake of the spiritual atmosphere of the shrines, recognizing that we are visiting a place where the atoms of the remains of the manifestation are like anybody else's atoms, but recognizing that the presence of the manifestation of God in that body during that period of existence has left a spiritual atmosphere with it. It is for this reason that we have the description of the shrines in the Baha'i writings. For example, Shoghi Effendi refers to the shrine of the Bab as a focal center of divine illumination and power, the very dust of which Abdu'l-Bahá averred had inspired him. Why are we saying this? Because there is a spiritual atmosphere associated with the remains of the manifestation of God in the shrine of the Bab. It goes beyond even the manifestation. For example, in 1939, Shoghi Effendi interred the remains of members of the Holy Family of Baha'u'llah. He interred them on Mount Carmel in what we now call the Monument Gardens. The remains of the Greatest Holy Leaf, those of her brother, the Purest Branch, and the mother, and they are now interred on Mount Carmel. And when the Guardian did that in 1939, he said that this action he took incalculably reinforces the spiritual potencies of that consecrated spot. This is the same point made here, that these are physical remains, their atoms no different from anyone else's atoms, but there is a spiritual atmosphere associated with it. So now we have certain locations in the world that have a spiritual atmosphere associated with them. In a sense, it is a broad extension of the magnetic principle to include inanimate places as well as actions taken by living human beings today to attract the spirit of the cause. That those places, such as the monument gardens, shrines, and the like, have a spiritual power with them. Related to that, Shoghi Effendi referred once more to the monument gardens and to the association of the three figures of the faith, the Bahia Khanum, Purest Branch, and Mother, and he said about it an even more mysterious thing. He said the association of these three incomparably precious souls, I'm skipping out some bits, in such a potentially powerful spiritual and administrative center is in itself an event which will release forces that are bound to hasten the emergence of the world order of Baha'u'llah. Now we're going even beyond this into really far out on a limb kind of things. We've proceeded to say that the association of these members of the Holy Family, their remains in the Monument Gardens, creates a center of spiritual power. Okay, fine. We can accept that. But the Shoghi Effendi has gone even further, and he said that association, creating that sense of spiritual path, is bound sooner or later to release forces that will hasten the emergence of the world order of Baha'u'llah. And we strive in vain to find a simple explanation. Because what we're seeing is the very act on the part of the Guardian of bringing those sacred remains and interring them on Mount Carmel hasten the emergence of forces which would lead to the development of the world order of Baha'u'llah. We say to ourselves, what on earth is the connection? How can it be that we are saying that his act of moving the remains from point A to point B and reinterring them on Mount Carmel could hasten the emergence of the world order of Baha'u'llah? What on earth could be even the remotest connection between those two things? And it can only be understood in terms of the existence of the spiritual world, the existence of spiritual powers, the connection between spiritual and material. The action of the Guardian in creating the monument gardens and the remains interred there is an act of spiritual consequence. That spiritual consequence leads to an energizing of the forces that are bringing about the world order. Baha'u'llah can only be understood in spiritual terms. This brings me to what is basically my final point, and that is to extend the concept of locations having spiritual power associated with them to beyond holy shrines to Mashriq al-Azkar. Shoghi Effendi in the 1950s, when he called upon us to erect a number of additional Mashriq al-Azkars, I guess Kampala and Frankfurt and Sydney, he wrote about it in very unusual and mysterious terms. He described each of these Mashriq al-Azkars as a tabernacle for the glorification of the Messenger of God. That's not particularly mysterious, it's what you expect. But then he described each of these Mashriq al-Azkars as a house for the indwelling Spirit of God. And that is strange. What he's telling us is that by going ahead and building the Mashriq al-Azkar, and I'm sure this is applicable also to the Mashriq al-Azkar of Samoa and Panama and Chile when the thing is built, that they are houses for the indwelling Spirit of God. At one level we say to ourselves, hey, come on, they're concrete and steel and glass and wood, and you're telling me that by arranging concrete and wood and steel in an appropriate way, the indwelling Spirit of God occupies it. That is very strange. Exactly right. Exactly right. Just by arranging atoms of carbon and nitrogen and phosphorus and calcium and whatever, it becomes a house for the indwelling human spirit for a certain period of existence. It is the magnetic principle taken almost to its limit. In the case of the Mashriq al-Azkar, we have an edifice constructed in accordance with divine prescription and being conducted in accordance with divine prescription, it attracts spiritual powers by the magnetic principle. And Shoghi Effendi describes the attraction of that spiritual power as representing the construction of a house for the indwelling Spirit of God. And in that sense, the Mashriq al-Azkar has a profound spiritual mystery to it. It's more than just a fancy building, more than just a beautiful place to go and worship, and it's cool in the summer and the like. It is rather a place we go to, and when we go to it, we know that we are in the presence of a location of what Shoghi Effendi describes as the indwelling spirit of God, and so we react appropriately to it. And that, of course, is increasingly characteristic of the way we are treating the houses of worship, that we're beautifying them, and the people who are chosen to be the caretakers or the custodians of these houses of worship recognize increasingly the enormous privilege and responsibility they have been given to be custodians of an edifice which is, as the Guardian describes, the house of the indwelling Spirit of God. As time goes on, that will become increasingly apparent. As decades go by, so the attitudes we show to these Mashiach Azkars will reflect our recognition of their spiritual significance. But I wanted to mention that as yet another example of the magnetic principle carried almost to its limit, to inanimate or seemingly inanimate objects which are constructed, but which are constructed in accordance with divine prescription. In that sense, then, the magnetic principle is as broad as it is long. It is without limit in description of human conduct, human attitudes, the collective actions of human beings in the administrative order, and then beyond that into the construction of places, locations on the earth which have a spiritual significance beyond that of the commonplace events and places of the earth. Okay, let's stop at this point because time is almost gone, and I want to leave time for any questions you might have on any subject of interest to you. And my presentation this morning and my presentation over these 4 days has been deliberately designed to raise issues for further consideration rather than to present a complete statement on this subject. There are lots of things to be thought about. This thing this morning about the interaction between the individual and the environment. What I've said is superficial. There's a huge amount more to be thought about it. The whole concept of magnetic principle is something to be developed even further. There is much more in the writings on this subject than I have mentioned, partly because of lack of time and partly because of lack of understanding on my part. You'll find if you can locate the tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá to Dr. Forel, F-O-R-E-L, that you'll find that it is a lengthy tablet which is chock-a-block full of very profound statements, some of which I've mentioned in the presentations during this series. I've struggled with the tablet of Dr. Forel over a lengthy period of time, and I've found it necessary to supplement it by looking at relevant passages of promulgation of universal peace and some answered questions, as well as some other places. And even after having struggled with it for what really is several years, I still realize that all I have done is scratch the surface of a very profound tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá in which he sets out the whole of the big picture of creation, involving individuals and society and astrophysics and all kinds of things. It is something that I think people will study for centuries into the future and will get far greater wisdom from it than I have even alluded to today. So the whole purpose of this presentation is to encourage you to make your own study of these subjects and to proceed to take it even further. Anyhow, now let's stop and see if anybody has any questions. Yep.
Talking about the FOCA
Yeah.
About many cultures, they have a different thing. Are there associations to the spirit or because of the non-existence of the evil? So what are these things?
Yeah. This question concerns the breadth of the application of the principle of association of spirit with certain objects and places in the universe. One has to look at the application of that principle in conjunction with the rest of the teachings, because the rest of the teachings say that there is no independent force of evil. And so the whole theory of voodoo, as I understand it, rests upon the existence of an independent force of evil which is attracted by the practice of voodoo. You make the voodoo doll and stick pins in it or something like that, and that arouses or energizes these evil forces. So one has to be careful of extending it even more broadly than is legitimate from the teachings. Nevertheless, I think it's appropriate to consider that there are certain areas in the world where humans have, for example, suffered immensely, and therefore it has left its trace. I remember a Baha'i who lived in one of the islands of the Northern Marianas. I can't remember whether it was Tinian or Rota, and it is an island where many, many soldiers committed suicide as the American forces were advancing in the Northern Marianas. And this Baha'i told us how she would walk along the cliffs of that island and find herself moved to saying the prayer for the dead because of the association of the suffering that had occurred at that time with that atmosphere. So it wasn't a matter of anything in the teachings, wasn't a matter of any negative forces or the power of evil, rather the fact that locations have an association with them. And I think that kind of extension is valid. Yes.
My question relates to the issue of tests that
you
in your talk yesterday. I've read this prayer for many, many years where it says, I'm prepared to endure any ordeal in thy path and desire with all my heart and soul to meet any hardship. And then goes on to say, oh God, protect me from tests.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The question actually is whether we read from the lives of Daniel Bloom and Abdul Baha how they met hardship and ordeal with such radiant acquiescence. And yet we understand that one's spiritual growth and development is dependent on tests. So if a person is leading a life that seems to outward perception and also to the perception of that individual as being very comfortable, very easy, very happy, does that mean that they're not being tested? Or does it mean that they've reached a level of spirituality that they need these tests and hardships with acquiescence and joy and just kind of pass over them like a person caught in a rip curl can either resist or can just flow through it? And if that's, I mean, whatever the answer may be, should one pray for tests, or do they just come?
It's a very complex question, this one, because it brings up all kinds of things. For a start, we are not masochistic. We're not people who enjoy suffering. We're told, as I've read several passages already, that Baha'u'llah says he desires for us a comfortable life, and he fosters moderation, and we don't seek austerities and mortification of the flesh. So we don't go out looking to suffer. At the same time, this is to be looked in conjunction with the fact that we're told in one of the passages that tests are an inevitable element of life. They will come, like it or not, and we should recognize that that's part of life. It also, another point of it, it's many different elements, another point of it is that not any everything is the same at all times. There are times when you feel you're not being tested, and there are other times when you feel you have more tests than you know what to do with. You know, there's an ebb and a flow and an unevenness to the events of life. And it may be that you may be in the calm before the storm when you feel as if, hey, I'm not getting tested at the moment, or it may be that you're being tested in ways that you don't recognize at the present time. So there's a number of complications as part of it. I think we are told in the prayers that we can pray for tests, but I take that to be in relation to the big picture, to recognize that tests are an inevitable part of the life, and things that I'm going through are part of a testing for which I should see the spiritual purpose and benefit. Why is this thing happening to me? Why is it that every time I get into a mess, it's the same kind of thing over and over again? What is the lesson I'm supposed to learn? How am I to go through it? In other words, to look at it within context of one's spiritual growth. As far as Abdu'l-Bahá and Bahir Kanum and the serenity of their lives, which certainly is certainly true, that has to be looked at in conjunction with what they went through. Abdu'l-Bahá had this marvelous serenity, this marvelous insight into creation and what was going on and what was happening, but also look at Abdu'l-Bahá at the time of construction of the Shrine of the Bab. He says, in quoting God Passes By, that one night he was so hemmed in by his anxiety over whether this character would sell him the land that was indispensable for the Shrine of the Bab, that he could do nothing but recite a prayer of the Bab that was in his possession basically all through the night, hundreds of times. Well, that implies a certain degree of distress. And so his serenity, his recognition of the big picture of the overall scheme of creation did not exclude periods of enormous distress. You find other examples in the life of Abdu'l-Bahá where he was just beset by trials and torment and difficulties from every direction. Yet that was within context of his overall serenity about the purpose of life and the purpose of what was going on. So it has a complexity to it that cannot be reduced to one or two simple things. And one has to read more broadly and look for the unity of meaning of the various relevant passages. And you've just read one or two, but there's a whole lot more facets that have to be put together to get a unified meaning of it. Yeah. Yeah.
And how the spiritual principle, over time, the spiritual powers will be manifested, right. And at a certain point, this pattern will be disrupted. Does that also fully apply to the administrative order and to the covenant until the next manifestation comes?
Okay, the interesting question concerning the coming of the next manifestation and concerning the fact, does the principle that I have described of the formation of the organic unit and ultimately the extinction of the organic unit and the spirit going elsewhere, does that apply to the administrative order with the coming of the next manifestation? We have very little information about the conditions associated with the coming of the next manifestation. We have an enormous amount of speculation, all of which is very interesting, but not authoritative. We do have a few authoritative statements, and one of these is a answer by the Guardian to a question that was raised about day not being followed by night. And the Guardian was asked what that meant, and the Guardian, his response, as I recall, was that what it refers to is the fact that in this dispensation it will not disintegrate into disunity as occurred with previous dispensations before the coming of the next manifestation, that there won't be a rise and then a fall of disintegration, so that unity will be preserved. That seems to imply that the institutions of the cause will continue to function, because without the institutions of the cause, we won't have preservation of unity. They're designed to preserve unity. In that sense, we make the inference that these institutions will continue right up to the coming of the next manifestation. I might add that this is a kind of question that youth were inclined to ask very frequently when I was living in the United States and conducting youth sessions. And as a result, I found that I memorized where the Guardian had said that. And so I would always find an opportunity to display my superior knowledge by telling them where it was. And it's in the United States Behind News for January 1935. This is not a readily accessible source, so usually you could offer that reference and get out of town before anybody found out about it. So, but certainly it leads to the inference that we're not going to have a disintegration of institutions before the coming of the next manifestation. But the passage also points out that the next manifestation will be subject to rejection and test and persecution, as in the past. So we say, well, hey, now we're getting into a contradiction, and what about the House of Justice and all this kind of stuff? There you get into the realm of speculation. I have my own speculations, but they're basically worthless. But certainly those are the kinds of things we have that are authoritative on that subject. And eventually people get all worked up in a lather about it, and then we can quieten them down by saying, you won't be around at the time, don't bother. Which is a very good way of putting somebody down. Anyhow, yeah.
Thank you. I would just like to ask, after Jesus Christ, Muhammad came, is he a manifestation from God for the whole world? Because Christ said that he will return again in the spirit, the same spirit. Mm-hmm. Is this the same spirit? Is this same spirit in Muhammad or not?
I think you'll find in the Kitab-e-Khan, in the Book of Certitude, Baha'u'llah refers to the spirit of the manifestation of God, and how there is a form of return in the future manifestations of God. In that sense, yes, Muhammad represents the return of the Christ spirit, but there is a different emphasis with each manifestation of God, just as there is with the Bab and Baha'u'llah. So the short answer is yes, it's the same spirit returned in a different context, in a different setting, and therefore with different needs.
Just thinking about the indwelling spirit of God.
Yes.
Appearing in the Baha'i houses of worship, it made me then think about the seat of the Universal House of Justice. Uh-huh. And I was thinking perhaps the indwelling spirit of God might be there as well. And then I also thought, Peter up there on stage, he's served on the Universal House of Justice. So I was just wondering, while you were serving on the Universal House of Justice, my question to myself was, I wonder if you ever felt the indwelling spirit of God serving on that institution. And then I thought it could be a different experience for each person. And if you were totally moved to tears all the time and carried away, you wouldn't get much work done because you might be weeping all the time. And you'd probably have to be quite pragmatic and think of the task in hand. But I was also thinking, if there were any pointers, if you could answer any of those questions, getting back to the baby institutions of the LSAs, if there were any pointers that you could give to LSAs and how we could be preparing ourselves for each meetings. And I was thinking of quantity, How long do you pray for and all that kind of stuff to try and prepare for LSA meetings? Yep.
Yeah. We should make that the last question or we won't get to coffee. In preparing these series of presentations, like most other people, I had more material than I knew what to do with, and so I chopped bits out as I went along. One of the bits I chopped out in this presentation is in the latter part of it, after we did Mashugal Azkar. They said, there's a passage from Abdu'l-Bahá, "Know thou of a certainty that every house where the anthem of praise is raised to the realm of glory in celebration of the name of God is indeed a heavenly home and one of the gardens of delight in the paradise of God." And another place where Abdu'l-Bahá refers to having meetings of Baha'is in one's house. And he says that that house will become a house of heaven, and that fabric of stone, a congress of the spirit. There's yet another place where he says, "When a company of people shall gather in a meeting place, engage in glorifying God, speak with one another of the mysteries of God, the breathings of the Holy Spirit will blow upon them." And the point is that whenever we praise God, whenever we worship God, whenever we gather in a location for a divinely endowed spiritual purpose, the Spirit is attracted and the area is sanctified. And that applies broadly. It doesn't simply apply to the seat of the House of Justice or to any other place. It applies rather to the location where the Spirit is glorified. And in the case of the Universal House of Justice, its powers and functions are not restricted to the building in which it commonly meets. It meets in all kinds of places. Maybe you meet at Bhaji or whatever, as a need arises and the Spirit is associated with it. Let me make 2 points and then we'll stop. The next point I want to make is simply the fact that those of us who have served on the Universal House of Justice are very conscious of the sanctity of the location where the House of Justice gathers, whether it's in somebody's office or whether it's in our council chamber where the House of Justice commonly meets or whatever. We would realize that there was a sense of occasion, a sense of significance to the meeting of the House of Justice, and we would conduct ourselves appropriately, knowing that we are in the presence of a mysterious spirit beyond ourselves. We're conscious of this, not to the extent of being paralyzed from carrying out our function, but being aware that it was a very, very special place, a special occasion, and required a special degree of behavior. This did not mean that we were not relaxed with each other. The House of Justice functioning is one that includes quite a lot of hard work, but it's done in a spirit of joy and happiness and being very pleased with each other's presence. I noticed that sometimes, very rarely, not very often, once in a blue moon, House of Justice would finish its agenda before the end of meeting time. Meeting time is supposed to end at 5:30, and sometimes it would be 4:45 or 4:50, and the agenda would be finished. And what I notice is that when that occurs, the members would tend to just sit back and chat with each other. There was no anxiety to have to leave and get away to one's own self. We just enjoyed each other's presence and enjoyed each other's company, whether it was for formal or informal occasions. And that was the character of the meeting. And there were moments of lightheartedness and things that were said of a lighthearted nature within the context of the consultation, but was within the ever-present awareness of the special nature of it. Finally, and at the end of it, I want to tell you of a very strange experience that Jen and I had when we were living in the state of Michigan. Lived in a place called Ypsilanti, Michigan, and we had a house which we moved into after living in an apartment. It was a reasonably small house, and we didn't have much money, so it had very little furniture. And it was fine, we survived, and it was okay. And we had a few things on the wall, but we also had a poinsettia, a little plant, which we had in the living room, and in order to have something to decorate it. And like all the plants we would buy from time to time, it would sooner or later die. Largely because we were basically incompetent at keeping the thing alive, and partly because we were busy. So we'd get this poinsettia plant, and it would limp along for a while, and obviously it would develop a certain resentment that it wasn't being watered, and eventually it would give up and die. During the course of this, my parents came to visit us, I think in 1972, and stayed with us for a couple of weeks, I guess. And we'd rush off to work early in the morning, because we were both working at the University of Michigan, about 10 miles away, and leave my folks to get their own breakfast and get themselves organized. We'd come back after work and do things with them in the evening. My father was very much from, those of you who knew my father, very much from the Asian tradition, in the sense that he devoted several hours of the day to prayer. And so after they had their breakfast, my father would go to this front living room of our little house, and he'd say his prayers. Or you and I would say our prayers, and that's it. He would say his prayers, and it went on for a very long period. And he did this each day, and they enjoyed being in our place, and everything was fine. The point of my story is that this poor old poinsettia plant was in the living room with my father when he was saying the prayers each day. And to our astonishment, it was kind of spooky. In fact, this poinsettia plant responded by going crazy. It developed itself, new branches, new leaves, better color, grew quite large. And it wasn't as if we were remembering to water it and forgetting at other times. It was just sitting there being treated the same terrible ways we treat any other poinsettia plant. The only thing we could see different was the fact that these prayers for several hours of the day were being recited in that room, and we came to the conclusion that these prayers were creating a spiritual atmosphere, simply the result of which was that good old poinsettia responded to that and did its thing and grew in a very wonderful way. So to us it was a confirmation of what Abdu'l-Bahá says about a home in which God is glorified and prayers are offered and spiritual activities are occurring, that the very atmosphere of it is affected. At the same time, this is a very inadequate proof. It could be simply that my folks were watering the thing surreptitiously, or it could be that the air in the room was being disturbed during the day, and that was beneficial to the poinsettia. There are all kinds of other reasons, but it was something that remains in our memory as a very strange and interesting thing. Thank you very much.